We are joined on the line from London, England, and from San Francisco in the United States, two organizers with the Global Women's Strike. So welcome, Dee Dee from London and Nell from San Francisco.
Hi.
Hi, thanks.
So welcome, and can you start by talking about the grassroots local organizations that you work with and how you are celebrating International Women's Day today and participating in the Global Women's Strike. Dee Dee, maybe we can start with you.
Okay, thanks very much for having us on your program. And today in London, we're joining with women in over 60 countries who are taking action and calling for investment in caring and not killing. We're really pressing wherever we are for the over $1 trillion squandered, over half by the U.S. government, on death and destruction, wars and occupations. And we want that money instead invested in our communities wherever we are, whatever country we're in. We want food security, we want land rights, we want clean drinking water, payment for caring work, non-polluting technology, freedom of movement, and much more. And this week, to just today, we're having a lovely open day at the Women's Centre in London, and we're having videos on women and men who are campaigning in Venezuela, which I'm sure we'll talk a bit more about, in the revolutionary process. We're having a beautiful exhibition from the trip that some of us went to Venezuela recently for the World Social Forum and to meet with grassroots organizers there. We're having delicious food cooked by the All African Women's Group, who do a lot of work to stop themselves getting deported and to help others in prison who are, you know, get women and children who are put in prison who are seeking asylum by the UK government. And we're having a drop-in, so that's some of what we're doing here. And this Friday, we're also going to have a film showing and discussion and bring news of the Haitian resistance, you know, resistance that grassroots women and men in Haiti are doing against the U.S. occupation. So I'm looking forward to that. So I'm sure Nell has got a lot of news from over in San Francisco.
Yeah,
Nell.
Actually, in the United States, we have at least three locations where Global Women's Strike is going to be having activities, including in Philadelphia, where they're going to be having a speak out at the welfare department. There's a Justice is Appealing campaign happening there, and so they're going to be having, you know, women speak out about the atrocious cuts in welfare that they're surviving and, you know, trying to cope with. And then this weekend they're going to be doing a Venezuela report back as well. In L.A., they're going to be having survivors and supporters speak out, and Second Line, which is a New Orleans tradition. So, you know, we've been working with hurricane evacuees in both L.A. and San Francisco. So the L.A. event is happening this weekend, and it's going to be focused on honoring the survivors of Katrina and Rita and FEMA and Bush. And then in San Francisco, our activities will be happening actually a little later in the month, and they also will be focused on the work that we're doing here with the Hurricane Evacuee Council of the Bay Area. We've been supporting a network of evacuees since November in the Bay Area to put forward their demands, which include permanent housing and the information that they need to be able to have their cases move forward. They're demanding help with transportation, money and resources that they're entitled to, work, living wage work, and survival income. Work, you know, payment for all of our work.
Nell, you're in San Francisco. Can you give our listeners some kind of picture of the situation for the Hurricane Katrina and Bush and FEMA survivors? And on a national level, like, how many people are we talking about? I know it's a huge problem, but can you try and sketch it out for us about, you know, what the impact has been for people who've had to leave their homes in New Orleans, and what the prospects are for them to return or otherwise restart their lives somewhere else?
Yeah. thanks for asking, because part of the problem has been that the coverage has been fairly minimal and focused a lot on what happened back in November and not what's continuing to happen to the evacuees right now. The hurricane season in the New Orleans and the Gulf region displaced, the official numbers are like 2 million people. And out of New Orleans alone, 350,000 people have not been able to return yet. 350,000 out of 410,000 total population. So, a tremendous number of people were displaced. We don't really know how many precisely because FEMA has been completely uncooperative in terms of releasing information about where people are. It has, been unfair to try to negotiate the bureaucracy of FEMA from hotel rooms. A lot of people got pushed from hotel room to hotel room. In the last waves of eviction, which happened February 7th and February 13th, there were estimates that 20,000 people were evicted from hotels in each one of those waves. So that's like 40,000 people this month who found themselves pushed into the arms of family or into the, already overloaded shelters that are in the cities across the country where folks landed, which is, 44 different states. So the work here in the Bay Area has been about finding evacuees. And once we got a call about a woman who had been threatened with eviction because she complained about the Red Cross and FEMA mistreatment on TV. So we were contacted. We got in touch with her and began to work with her on her case. And as we worked with her on her case, we met other evacuees in the hotel she was staying in. We figured out some other hotels that folks were in. So we began to contact folks, and the consensus was that they needed to begin to meet together to form a council, because the story that they were each telling was there were so much the same about not being able to get through the FEMA bureaucracy. Being hung up on, being getting repeated busy signals, waiting on hold perpetually, and then, not being able to make progress on the case, just nightmares. And so now we're 6 months out from the event, and still there are thousands of people across the country who have cases who are not resolved in the minds of the evacuees themselves, although FEMA has given them some declaration of being ineligible. So we have been pressing FEMA. We've had protests outside the FEMA regional office, which happens to be here in Oakland, which is right across the bay from San Francisco. And we have done a lot of media work. We've held press conferences and had meetings with public officials and elected officials so that the individual cases of the council members and then the overall picture for evacuees all across the country can be understood, and some attention would be focused on, seeing to it that these folks get what they need to reestablish their lives and make decisions about whether or not they want to return to New Orleans.
Thank you. Can you just spell it out for our listeners? How do you see this work as connected to your work in women's movement, in grassroots women's movements, and connected to the
I'm representing women of color in the global women's strike, and women of color, women in general, and women of color are disproportionately impacted by the policies of devastation, destruction that the Bush administration promotes, along with throwing a lead around the world. It's disaster is big business, and they don't mind putting women to work surviving disasters and then, holding our families together, trying to rebuild our families, rebuild our communities on, very little or nothing, while they get big payouts from the governments, to have the various whether it's the FEMA bureaucracy, which is part of Homeland Security here in the United States. So they, take their part in doing what they call disaster recovery. And then we have to fight them to get the money that we need to do the work that we have to do, or the outrageous contracts that go out. It was just in the news that FEMA just closed a $17 million morgue in Baton Rouge that they built since Katrina. They were anticipating huge numbers of bodies to have to process. And in fact, they're still finding bodies. So the morgue wasn't even, you know, put to the use that it was designed for, but the outrage of building a $17 million morgue in Baton Rouge while women are sitting in hotel rooms, you know, raising their kids, making sure that their kids still have something to eat, still have somewhere to be, stay on track for graduation, whatever the work is that women do. So we, you know, we see that the money that's generated by our work and the waged workers, that money is squandered on the military. And, you know, our work is undervalued and underpaid, although it's beginning to be recognized more.
Let's move to talk about the campaign to have that work recognized that you're so much a part of and so much have represented internationally, and that has seen some results now in Venezuela. Can you talk about the moves in Venezuela to compensate women for their work in the home?
Yes. We had, while we were there, there was women and men, because we also work with the Payday Men's Network, who, in fact, have been also in touch with U.S. soldiers who have refused to fight in the war in Iraq and are seeking asylum in Canada, amongst men in other countries, women and men in other countries. But while we were there in Venezuela, from African countries, from Latin America, from the U.S., including Native American women, from England, from Spain, from India, from Guyana, for the World Social Forum, and to meet with grassroots organizers there, we were absolutely delighted to hear on the 3rd of February, President Chavez, who has fantastic grassroots support. I mean, everyone, especially women, starting with women, who are really leading that revolution, they love him because they know that he really respects women and talks about our work and talks about how hard women work, including his mother, his grandmother. And he's now announced that the poorest women, especially single mothers with two or three children who are not married, who do not have any other support, will get a wage from the government of 372,000 bolivares, which is about $180 a month, equivalent to 80% of the minimum wage. And that is starting in June. So the first 100,000 women will get that money in June, another 100,000 in July, up to 500,000 women. And we think it's a fantastic victory for women everywhere. We wish we had that here in the UK and in other countries. You know, they spend so much money on war, on destruction and occupations, and on tax relief for multinational companies. They give them so many advantages and privileges, and they always say they haven't got the money, you know, to pay women for our work. So we're going to really be pressing to have that here in the UK. And women, we know when we heard the announcement, we were with organizers in the land committees and in the committees for the health committees and education committees. We were actually in Los Teques in Venezuela, and they were just delighted. Women just were clapping and cheering, and people are thrilled, and they're really looking forward to getting that money, because one of the problems is that because really it's women who are really the driving force and putting a lot of time and hard work into the different community projects, which is benefiting the whole community, they're really doing all that work for nothing, unwaged, and they're really struggling to make ends meet. And, you know, of course, then mothers are responsible. You know, we have our kids, we have our families looking after. So that money is really urgently needed, and we hope it extends to more women, and we think it's fantastic. And, you know, we will continue to support the revolution in Venezuela, to support women in Venezuela, and to support President Chavez, because he's really accountable to grassroots people.
The global women's strike has been associated with the International Women Count Network. And for many years, you've lobbied to have women's work recognized as part of the economy, to have it counted, in a sense, to have the information collected. and so that there can be a movement to recognize it and compensate women for that. Can you talk about progress that's been made in other places and on a global level?
Well, we think through, I mean, since 1972, there was the International Wages for Housework campaign was founded then, and the strike has been going since 2000. And in between, like you say, there was also an initiative to count women's work. And we do feel that, you know, really millions of women in the world are really pressing in different ways to have their work counted and recognized. And, you know, we want it paid for. We do. And we think that the work, including, you know, agricultural basic work that keeps whole countries surviving, 80% of the food in Africa is grown by women. Most of that is unwaged. You know, work like that, which is really the survival work of the whole planet, we think that should be recognized. I mean, this is the most concrete recognition in the form of payment in Venezuela that we know of. There's also been a bill in Trinidad and Tobago that was passed as well in the government, you know, to some counting women's work. Also in the UK, there was a bill, but nothing has happened. The government has never implemented that, and they're trying to here in the UK cut back welfare all the time, cut back the health services. You know, they treat immigrant people, you know, terribly. Have a lot of racist, sexist immigration laws. There's really a big struggle going on to really get hold of that money, because if it's not coming to us as women, it's going into military budgets, and we all know. And can see, you know, the result of that. We had a woman who was speaking, a doctor and a mother whose son is in prison in Palestine, who was speaking here as part of the International Women's Week events in London. You know, and it was, you know, the women are really up against it in Palestine, and she was telling us the conditions, you know, and how their sons throw stones at the tanks and are shot by the Israeli military. But, you know, women are very determined, and I think we are organizing in the global women's strike to keep up that pressure on governments. And, you know, the women's strike is growing, and we think we're going to win. We know this is fantastic in Venezuela, and this will give us a lot of strength and encouragement in whatever countries we're in to press our governments for the same and more.
A question for both of you. The global women's strike focuses on organizing with grassroots women, working women, women who obviously have so many responsibilities already. Can you talk about the challenges and what you've learned about organizing among women, among people who are already stretched to the limit? What are some of the ways that are, you know, how are you effective in organizing in communities that are already so taxed?
The grassroots struggles that you're speaking of are, you know, folks who are marginalized in the society. For instance, in Benton Harbor, Michigan, residents there are living under apartheid conditions. Benton Harbor is 97% black, and 70% of the residents there are without employment. So, you know, I really want to echo your point, which is that folks are really, facing real, you know, financial challenges. So the base of our work is to go after concrete wins so that people's condition is actually affected, you know, positively impacted. So if I can refer back to the Hurricane Evacuee Council of the Bay Area, in the work that we've been doing, you know, those demands, they are the basis for individuals to be able to say, whether it's to FEMA or to the city governments where folks are living, or to the Red Cross or the other myriad nonprofits that have gotten, you know, millions of dollars of funding to provide services for these folks. You know, we're saying to those, you know, those folks who got those contracts and those dollars, we want those dollars. Because people need them to be able to take care of the basic needs that they have. So it makes sense from the perspective of the people, we're organizing on our own behalf. I'm a full-time caregiver, so I'm currently, you know, having to press my case for my mother to be able to get the services that she needs as an 82-year-old elder, right? So it's not, uh, it's, it's that we, you know, that we organize not from the perspective of the do-gooder, but from the perspective of people who ourselves need these resources to be able to have lives that are, you know, full and have, and, you know, that are full and, you know, where we can take care of ourselves and our families and have leisure and, you know, and be and have lives that are full.
Didi, do you want to add to that?
Definitely. What Nell is saying is that one of the things that we do is we, you know, we work collectively and we really help each other out in working out what to do in different situations. From our own experience, like Nell says, you know, if you've been homeless or, you know, you've been on welfare, you know, if you're on welfare benefits, you're fighting an immigration case, it's very much a self-help approach, which does help because, you know, the work, obviously, women's workload is really increasing all the time. And, you know, it does also help, you know, we help fight to be able to get what we're entitled to, including money, including welfare benefits, including, you know, if women are, you know, threatened with discrimination at work, for example, and, you know, being thrown out of their work. And also, you know, things like even, I don't know, like, you know, looking after each other's kids, if someone's got to go to a meeting, if, you know, basic things like that, and just to try and really help each other out in all our communities, you know, so we can really get what we're all entitled to. And, I mean, that's the sort of practical day-to-day way that we know, right, and is all that we can do. You know, when you haven't got a lot of money and a lot of time, you just pool our resources as much as we can and our experiences.
Can you both talk about also the challenges of and what you gain in your international sort of networking? You know, what you've learned about working across national borders and across the divide between North and South. And of course, the North is also divided, right? And the South is also divided. But can you talk about what solidarity means to you and what you've learned through this process?
I was just in Venezuela as part of the Global Women's Strike delegation to the World Social Forum, and we were 70 plus women and men from, I think I counted, 9 different countries: Guyana, Uganda, Peru, Venezuela, the U.S., 3 places in the U.S., England, Italy, Spain, right? India. So for me, as a person, you know, monolingual, English-speaking, U.S. born and raised, the opportunity to be involved in a network of grassroots folks around the world who, you know, basically what I find is that we all have the same struggle, that we have perspectives from wherever we are living, but that we're facing similar conditions in terms of the people who are either elected or take power in our countries, take the resources and use them for their own benefit and for the benefit of a few people in the country. That is not a unique situation. It's not unique. That's how, you know, the power structure is operating in most places around the world, which is why I was so excited to be in Venezuela, where actually there is the political will of the state is being applied to eradicating poverty. When Hugo Chavez says the enemy is hunger, you know, who is the enemy? The enemy is hunger. That it means something that the resources are then devoted to addressing the needs of those of us at the bottom, so that our lives can be full and we can live with dignity and have our families, you know, not be under attack all the time in both the direct ways and also the insidious ways, like military recruitment. So anyway, what I want to say about the power of the international is that the each grassroots struggle connected internationally means that we have the collective power of the network, which is of course much stronger than our individual struggles in all these, you know, myriad places around the world.
Dee Dee in
Hi.
London. Hi. Would you like to comment on that question?
Yes. I mean, well, one thing to start off with is that, in fact, many of us also, like, for example, working the strike in London are immigrant women ourselves from different countries. And, I mean, we don't call ourselves the Global Women's Strike. We don't call ourselves a solidarity group because we are, as Nell was saying, we're sort of organizing together in very practically. We're campaigning in the countries where we are at the moment, and we're also supporting each other practically. For example, by maybe, I know, for example, in India, when they're doing the Chhattisgarh Women's Organization, which I'm sorry that you weren't able to read, because they do fantastic organizing work against bonded labor, you know, against to try and raise the salaries that women, because women are getting less salaries than the men working, for example, in agriculture, even though everyone's getting very low salary, also to get rape taken seriously, the rape by landlords of tribal and Dalit women. You know, these are just some of the examples of the fantastic organizing that they're doing. And, for example, they might send us some information which we can then publicize on internationally from the UK. And then, you know, we might be going to an anti-war march, like we're going to the International Anti-War March on the 18th of March. And women from Uganda, you know, in the past have sent us a fantastic anti-war statement and what war means to them in Uganda. And, you know, that's that sort of direct, practical exchange. There's also a lot you learn from each other, which bypasses a lot of the lies, you know, by the state media in many countries, really like in the US and the UK in particular. There's so much misinformation and lies spread by the media that when you actually meet each other, work together, there's a way that you can just hear directly what's happening in the different countries, in the different areas, and you find out how much, you know, you have in common. And how many of the struggles are similar, even though, of course, the conditions are a lot harder, often in countries of the south. And people are up against, also, for example, in India, terrible, you know, heat waves and droughts and floods now, which have increased with global warming. It also gives you a lot of strength and a lot of, you know, hope and strength. And you know that we're doing it all together on the 8th of March or around this date. And we get news. In fact, a lot of the news we get about actions of women taking part in the Global Women's Strike, we get afterwards, and it's just dynamite. We just hear a lot of ways that women have used the strike and used the power of international, you know, grassroots actions happening at a similar time to press for what women need in their area, in their region, in their village area, or in their city. And, you know, it has been a very a successful way of organizing because, you know, women, you win things. You know, women in Uganda won some free healthcare because they were part of an international action and, you know, and we're pressing in whatever country we are. You know, and now, for example, with the victory in Venezuela, we're, you know, we'll be pressing to have the similar thing. You know, we want payment for our caring work here in the UK and we're pressing against war. And in many countries, we're fighting against war, you know, so, you know, we're doing our best, but it gives you a lot of strength and a lot of encouragement.
We have been speaking with Dee Dee in London, the United Kingdom, and Nell in San Francisco, both working with the Global Women's Strike happening around the world today. Any final thoughts before we leave you this morning?
I want to give contact info for the Crossroads Women's Center in Philadelphia, which is where the Global Women's Strike operates out of. The phone number there is area code 215-848-1120. And Dee Dee, maybe you can give London?
Yeah, that would be great. Actually, what I'd like to do is give the Global Women's Strike website. Uh-huh. And for your listeners, please go on it. It's bilingual. It's in most of the information, Spanish as well as in English. It's www.globalwomenstrike.net. And you may also like to visit the Payday Men's Network, www.refusingtokill.net. And if you go, that has the contact details of, you know, different countries as well. But there is a lot of information of the different campaigns and the organizations in different countries which are part of the Global Women's Strike and Payday Men's Network. And thank you very much for having us on your program.
Thank you very much. And thank you especially to Nell, given that it's 6 in the morning right now. And we will check in with you again, hopefully over the next year, and not wait until March 8th to talk again.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, that's great. Thank you.
And happy International Women's Day.